The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
We all want justice. We say we want tolerance. And of course, we value liberty. And all of these beautiful virtues point to the possibility of peace. But here's the problem. We leave out one group of persons, expectant mothers and their preborn children. And the question before us today is why? Why? And that was the question that was debated today right across the street here at the Supreme Court. Why? We don't have to live like this. What we can do is live in authentic community with one another, where every person matters, including the expectant mother and her preborn child. That is called a community of care, where a tolerant, just, and inclusive society commits to this journey of life, before birth, at birth, and after birth.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
If you're wondering who that was, it was Representative Jeff Fortenberry. He's a Republican from Nebraska. He was speaking yesterday on the House floor. Good guy. He's been on this program many times. I hope a guy like that would run for higher office one day. I really do. Offering reflections after the Supreme Court of the United States heard the oral arguments, of course, for the case of Dobbs versus Jackson's Women Health Organization. Big, big story yesterday, to say the least. There'll be a lot to be discussed in the days ahead. And, of course, we're probably not going to know until June what the decision was. So it gives you more time to pray, right? That's what I've been doing. You know, earlier today I went to Mass. I spent time praying for this. I've been amping up some extra prayer for this particular intention. Because, you know, I say to myself, I'll just be honest with you. I look at the culture of death in our country. And I've got friends. I have a lot of respect for them. They commit every week to walking and praying outside of an abortion clinic. And my wife and I don't do that. And I guess sometimes it pricks my conscience. I'm thinking, you know what? We should do that. We should make that sacrifice. What am I doing to help speak truth? What am I doing to help those women in crisis? What am I doing to make a difference in this fight for life? You know, great, I got a microphone. Great, I can pray. I mean, those are important things. And I thank God for those platforms and that opportunity. But, you know, we can always do a little bit more. And if you're not doing anything either, and you're like me, you're like, oh, abortion's so wrong. It's evil. One day it'll, you know, then you need to pray a little bit more. I'm trying to do that. It would really be great if we could all sacrifice. I'm really bad at that, but I'm trying to do a little bit more of that. But you can sacrifice your time. Go and pray outside of these abortion clinics. And with 40 Days for Life or your local pro-life chapter, I'm sure they've got something going on. So check them out. The next several months are key. I mean, they are critical. And what's going to be debated, what's going to be heard, what's ultimately going to be written and decided will have implications not just on the unborn, but on mothers and fathers as well, and on our country and on the world. It really is. We're a global family here, so I hope the Supreme Court will get this one right and just pray that their minds are illuminated and, as I like to say, their hearts convicted, that they do the right thing, and pray for me that I can do more. You know, I often think back to the 1800s, 1860s, when the Civil War was raging. You know, Lincoln would go on to sign the Emancipation Proclamation freeing slaves. And I always thought, oh, if we were not to never have a slave, oh, you know, I would do everything I could to help abolish that. You all say that. You know, people risk their lives, their livelihood, to be part of the Underground Railroad, to speak truth. A lot of blood was you know, spilled during the Civil War. The bloodiest, you know, battle in U.S. history, bloodiest war, I should say. But, you know, what are we doing today? Abortion goes on every single day. We lose more children every day than we do in 9/11. Right. And we go about thinking about what we're going to have for dinner. Right. you don't give it a second thought. You don't give it a second thought. And that's, I know not everybody's that way, but that's just my own personal perspective on it. So I just, I was thinking about this decision. And I just think, look, in the next 6 months, you and I have an opportunity to do a lot more. I hope you'll do it. I hope you'll do something small. It doesn't be big. Just one small sacrifice or something that will make a difference. That's all. Just do whatever you can. All right. And if you're not familiar with what's going on, let me give you a quick thumbnail, and then we're going to be joined by one of my favorite guests coming up in a moment here. Professor Garnett's going to be stopping by, and we'll talk to him. share a couple things with you here. Supreme Court, right? They heard that case yesterday. I'm sure you heard it. It was headline news across the country. And it's a case that could overturn the Roe and the Casey decisions. And this is huge. It doesn't mean abortion is going to end. It'll go down to the state level. But Roe and its companion case, there's another case, Doe v. Bolton. They were both decided in 73. And what they did was they struck down all restrictions on abortion throughout the country. So 20 years later, you got Casey v. Planned Parenthood, Roe, though it did shift. It shifted some of the parameters for when states could place restrictions on abortions. And both cases relied heavily on viability, right? When's life begin? The time at which a baby would be able to survive also outside of the mother's womb. The problem with viability, though, is that it's an ever-changing time frame. When Roe was first decided, viability, they thought, was around 30 weeks. A couple weeks ago, check this story out, right? I just saw this. A little boy went home. He went home after being born at 21 weeks, just 21 weeks. So he's now the world record holder for the earliest born preemie, but that's nearly 4 months early. Think about that. So the question is, when is viability? If you can't establish a firm time frame, you know, in the facts of everyday life, how are you gonna put that in law? So a lot of analysts were looking and they wondered right now about two people. One, Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh. Brett Kavanaugh, of course, a Trump appointee. It's just a foregone conclusion that Justice Souter and Kagan and Sotomayor, they're gonna vote to keep Roe, okay? Unfortunately. So pray for them. You know, pray that they change their mind on Roe and Casey. But it's more than likely they're going to keep that in place. Kavanaugh is new to the bench, right? His first abortion case. Roberts has been something of a wild card lately, so it's hard to read him. But we heard from Kavanaugh. I'll play some audio for you coming up. And it seems clear that he's ready to vote to completely overturn Roe and Casey. Roberts seems to think they should be upended. It's not clear how far he's willing to go on it. And then, of course, the arguments that the liberal justices, like Kagan and Sotomayor and Souter, are offering. They want to keep the old case in place. They were primarily political and self-serving, if you ask me. Sotomayor, she said something weird, and I'll share it from her own mouth in a minute, but she made the statement. I was shocked by it, and I want to get Professor Garnett's take on this. She asked the question, will the institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and the reading of it are just political acts? What does that matter? I mean, why should it matter what the public thinks? You're supposed to interpret the law. You're supposed to rule on that. John McCormick at National Review put it this way: all decisions that are, you know, to overturn previous decisions, you know, they're viewed as political acts. I'm joined right now by Professor Richard Garnett. He is a longtime friend of the show, director of the Notre Dame program on church, state, and society, and concurrent professor of political science. And he teaches and writes about freedoms of speech and association and religion, about the about constitutional law. A couple things you can do. You can follow him on Twitter. I think you'll be glad you did. That's at Rick Garnett, and that's G-A-R-N-E-T-T. And or Garnett, I should say. I always want to say Garnett. Garnett. Good to have you back with me, Professor. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
I'm delighted to have you here. So I want your take. There was so much to talk about here. I thought about you as I was out yesterday as all this was unfolding. Without Chief Justice Roberts, I was thinking about this earlier, it seems like there are five justices that are willing to overturn Roe and Casey. Your thoughts, I'm curious about Roberts. How do you read him? Which direction do you think he's going to go?
Yeah, it was interesting to listen to the arguments. You know, only Justice Sotomayor really made much of an effort to try to say that Casey had been rightly decided. The other two Democratic appointees, Kagan and Breyer, as you pointed out in your setup, they were emphasizing institutional concerns and, you know, stare decisis and so on. But in my view, there are clearly at least six justices, including Chief Justice Roberts, who know that Roe and Casey were wrongly decided. Chief Justice Roberts, as you probably know, he was a law clerk to Justice Rehnquist, as I was, and Rehnquist was the dissenter in Roe. He wrote the lead dissent in Casey. I've always believed, and still do, that Chief Justice Roberts knows that Roe and Casey were wrongly decided. He has, as you said, sometimes embraced a policy of kind of go slow, perhaps, on some of these cases. I know there are some people who've disagreed with certain of his votes. I tend to think he's been pretty consistent and thoughtful, but I realize some people disagree about that. As I heard the arguments, I think, like you, it seemed pretty clear that there were three justices who were going to strike down the Mississippi law and support keeping the Casey precedent. I think it's pretty clear that there are five justices who not only know that Roe and Casey were wrong, but are prepared to kind of repent of those mistakes and give the issue back to the political process and try to perhaps undo the damage that Roe and Casey did to constitutional law. And I believe that's what John Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, is going to do as well. He was exploring in the oral argument the possibility of some kind of a middle ground that would make it possible to uphold Mississippi's law, which bans abortion after 15 weeks. And that's a law that's clearly unconstitutional under if Casey's the law. And Roberts seemed to be exploring the possibility of, you know, retaining a constitutional right to abortion, but still upholding the Mississippi law. And what was interesting was that neither side seemed to have any, the lawyers didn't have any interest in that middle ground. The people defending abortion rights said, no, there's no middle ground. And the lawyer for Mississippi said pretty much the same thing. So I sort of took Chief Justice Roberts to be really kind of setting it out there for those who were following the argument, like in a sense, he was underscoring the point that the court really has to decide either the Mississippi law goes or Roe and Casey go. There really isn't a way to thread the needle in any other way, it seems to me.
Viability. Speak to that if you could, because that's really the heart of this issue too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's in there. So, you know, viability, by which the court means the point at which an unborn child could survive outside of the mother, which of course moves with science. Yeah. That wasn't a part of the original Roe decision. The original Roe decision was sort of cobbled together in a strange way and ended up assigning constitutional significance to each trimester. Then in Casey 30 years ago, the court, maybe a little sheepishly, got rid of the trimester framework and instead used viability as kind of an important touchstone for evaluating abortion regulations. And the idea was that before viability, states can't invoke their interest in unborn life as a reason for banning abortions. So in addition to viability, and this is what a lot of the oral argument was about, there was an undue burden standard. And the idea there was that regulations that fall short of a ban, think of like informed consent laws or laws about the facilities where abortions are performed and so on, that those laws all get evaluated on the with reference to the question whether they impose a quote-unquote undue burden on the right to abortion. And so one of the thought experiments that was kicking around in some quarters yesterday was that maybe you could get rid of the viability line, but keep the undue burden inquiry. And that would enable, some people thought, the court to say, well, 15 weeks, a 15-week ban, even though it's before viability, doesn't impose an undue burden on the right to abortion, because 15 weeks is enough time to get an abortion.
Sure.
But I think that I think it became pretty clear in the argument, and I feel very confident that this was Justice Kavanaugh's view in particular. The court knows that that would just be made up. And if one of the problems with Roe versus Wade is that it was just made up, why would these justices want to make up something else to kind of partially undo the thing they made up before? It just doesn't seem very plausible to me.
You know, 15 weeks, plenty of time. I think that's not going to be an issue. I had heard Alexandra DeSantis point out that the attorney for the Mississippi Abortion Clinic told the justice, including a friend of yours, you're friends with Amy Coney Barrett, the other justice, that having children is an obstacle to having a career. That doesn't seem like a very strong argument, does it?
Well, certainly the evidence that, you know, there were some prominent women lawyers who would think otherwise, including Justice Barrett, and Zan DeSantis is always insightful on this stuff. But to put that in context, I mean, one of the arguments that the defenders of Roe and Casey are making is that the court shouldn't overrule those cases because for the last 50 years, women have organized their lives around the expectation that legal abortions will be available. This is one of the factors that you're supposed to consider when deciding whether or not to overrule a case, is whether there's a lot of reliance interests that have been built onto this. And so there were a couple of briefs filed in the Supreme Court by pro-life women, many professionals, lawyers, doctors, and so on, just taking issue with that point, saying that it's not in fact the case that women's advancement depends on an abortion right, or that having children is some kind of a death knell for professional ambitions. And I was glad to hear that being aired. Yeah. The other point, I know you didn't ask about this, but I can't resist. The weirdest moment for me was in the midst of Justice Sotomayor's performance, and that really is what it was. Kind of out of nowhere, she said something like, isn't the view that unborn children deserve legal protection simply a religious view? Just kind of declare that there was nothing to the pro-life position other than kind of religion. And by that she meant not reason, I suppose. And it was a strange suggestion, that as if it were the case that the only people in the United States who have reservations about Roe and Casey are people who do so for religious reasons. Certainly many do, but not all.
Yeah. Speaking of Sotomayor, what's your position on this? I was struck by something she said in addition to that. She suggested the Supreme Court somehow won't survive what she calls the stench of overturning Roe v. Wade. Let me play this for you. If you have not heard what she said, listen to this, and then we'll get Professor Garnett's take on this. Here's Justice Sotomayor.
Now, the sponsors of this bill, the House bill in Mississippi, said we're doing it because we have new justices. The newest ban that Mississippi has put in place, the six-week ban, the Senate sponsor said, we're doing it because we have new justices on the Supreme Court. Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts?
I was shocked by that statement. How do you read that? Why would she say something like that? Isn't the position of a justice to interpret the law and then rule accordingly? Should they be concerned about whether it's political or not, or it's perceived as being political?
Well, I gotta say, I actually think Justice Sotomayor is both right and wrong. So she's right in the sense that it is really important that the decisions of the Supreme Court not be merely political. That is, the meaning of the Constitution should not change simply because a different party comes into power or different justices come onto the court. She's right about that. Now, she's being a little bit disingenuous because she, and you know, like most people, frankly, believes that there are plenty of cases that she'd like to see overruled, and that she'd overrule if she could. If she had five votes to overrule the gun rights case, she would. So there's a little bit of a double standard going on here. But she is right, and I think those of us who are pro-life should agree with her, that the meaning of the Constitution shouldn't change just because Justices Barrett and Kavanaugh came on the court. It has the pro-life claim is that Roe was wrong. Right. And that was the political move. The political thing would be to stick with this error where the Supreme Court removed an issue from politics. I mean, Right. All that the Mississippi is really proposing is let the people decide, let the issue go back to politics. So again, there's a kernel of truth in Justice Sotomayor's point, but I think she applies that point incorrectly in this case.
I'm with you on that. I mean, speaking of the neutrality of the Constitution, Justice Kavanaugh had thoughts on that, especially in regards to the issue of abortion. Let me share with you what he said, and I'd like your takes on that as well. Here's another justice. Stand by.
I think the other side would say that the core problem here is that the court has been forced by the position you're taking and by the cases to pick sides on the most contentious social debate in American life, and to do so in a situation where they say that the Constitution is neutral on the question of abortion, the text and history, that the Constitution's neither pro-life nor pro-choice on the question of abortion. And they would say, therefore, it should be left to the people, to the states, or to Congress. And I think they also then continue, because the Constitution is neutral, that this court should be scrupulously neutral on the question of abortion, neither pro-choice nor pro-life. But because they say the Constitution doesn't give us the authority, we should leave it to the states, and we should be scrupulously neutral on the question. And that they are saying here, I think, that we should return to a position of neutrality on that contentious social issue rather than continuing to pick sides on that issue. So I think that's, at a big picture level, their argument.
So, Professor, I love your take on that. I have about a moment or two left. So I love your comments on what Justice Kavanaugh said, and also maybe where your friend Justice Barrett is in all this as well.
Yeah, I think Justice Kavanaugh makes a really important point that, but we need to be clear about what he's saying. It's not that the Supreme Court is neutral about everything or that the Constitution is neutral about everything. I mean, the Constitution takes a stand. The freedom of speech should be protected. The Constitution takes a stand that we have rights to be protected against, you know, unreasonable searches by the government. So those are clear positions that the Constitution takes out. But what Justice Kavanaugh was reminding people of is that the Constitution never said that abortion is one of those matters that we're going to take away from political debate. There are lots of really important questions that the Constitution says nothing about, like what should the top tax rate be, or should we go to war, or for that matter, should there be a death penalty? A lot of those issues are meant to be resolved through the democratic process. And I took Justice Kavanaugh to be reminding people that that's true of abortion as well. The fact that it's an important and divisive issue doesn't mean that the Supreme Court should swoop in, pick sides, and take the issue away from the people. And I take him to be saying, and I think he's going to vote this way, that the correct resolution of this case is to allow the abortion issue to return to the people. Yep. Some states will enact abortion laws that pro-life people like me don't like. Yep. There's going to be a whole lot of work to be done by pro-life people in a lot of states. It won't be over just because Casey is overturned. But Justice Kavanaugh's reminder there was important.
Well, Professor, thank you for your time and for your insight as well. I'm very grateful for it. How do you think it's going to shake out? I know we're not going to hear probably till June. Many people think it'll be the last day of their session. But when I look at the composition of the court, and again, I just look at it from a Catholic perspective, I would think it's going to go in favor of life. But give me your take.
Yeah, I'm on the record for several months now. I think it's going to be 6-3. The court will abandon Roe and Casey and uphold the Mississippi law. And I think Chief Justice Roberts will write the opinion doing so. And then that'll be the beginning of a new stage in the pro-life effort.
So what happens then? Just as there'll be outrage, of course. I mean, the media, those who are champions of this, Hollywood. I mean, there's going to be a huge cry as soon as this goes down. But then it goes to the state level. Do you think things are going to intensify there? What do you think? What do you see coming after that decision's made? Because I'm with you.
In some places, things won't change much at all. I mean, states like Virginia and New York already have maximally permissive abortion laws, and that won't change. Some states will adopt more restrictive laws than right. Casey permits. And, you know, frankly, America's abortion regime is more permissive than almost any other regime in the entire world. You know, the European countries tend to actually have more restrictive abortion regulations than we do. But there will be a lot of political mobilization around this. There'll be a lot of, as you say, outcry in the media. The evidence I'm seeing is that, in fact, most Americans don't get exercised about this issue. The post-Texas polling suggests as much. And those who do care about it tend to be on the pro-life side. So,
I agree. In fact, there was a poll that came out, Professor. You know, Democrats have always strongly supported abortion. Republicans have always been against it. There was a recent poll done, I think, last week that showed now attitudes have changed. They asked, should they let Roe stand? And I think it was like 53% of people polled Republicans said sure. It was a majority for a change. But again, it's the way the question was posed. I think most of the people think that when Roe is overturned, abortion is outlawed. They don't realize that it's still accessible in this country at the state level. So,
and they also don't realize when polls that ask people about Roe versus Wade are useless, because Americans just don't know how permissive the Roe-Casey regime is. Most Americans support regulations of abortion that Casey would not permit. You know, are most Americans kind of all in pro-life? No. But most of them aren't all in abortion rights either. Most think there can be restrictions. And the reality is, and Americans are often surprised to learn this, that Casey, taken along with a case that you mentioned in the setup, Doe, really do constitutionalize a regime of abortion on demand. And that's not what most people want.
All right. Well, Professor, I'll leave it there. Thank you for your time. Great to have you here. You can follow Rick Garnett on his Twitter page, at Rick Garnett. That's G-A-R-N-E-T-T. We'll continue to follow this. Hey, enjoy your Christmas if you and I don't talk again, okay? And thanks for your contribution over the year. It's always good to have you here.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks. Okay, take care. See you.
God bless you. All right, I got to take a short pause. When we come back, wait to hear about this one. There is an amicus brief being filed for women who've been injured by abortion. Stay with me. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
All the news and issues now that are happening now.
One place. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Now.
Yeah, a lot going on in the country. I told you we're living in a historic time. This is a great moment, I think, for the cause of life. I'll continue to ask you to pray for that and do your part. And we know the Supreme Court's got a lot to deliberate on. It's, you know, just about, I guess, all Supreme Court cases, there are third parties who are actually interested in the outcome of the case and who want the justice to roll, you know, to rule one way or the other. And those parties are allowed to submit what they call amicus briefs, right, or friend of the court briefs. And they do that to the justices to argue one way or the other. And look, there are hundreds of these briefs submitted to the Supreme Court on the Dobbs case. And you know, look, I certainly wouldn't want to be a clerk, really, who's got to read through all of them. Can you imagine that? God bless them. But one of those briefs was actually submitted by an interesting group of women. Check this out. 2,249 women, to be exact. They argued that abortion allowed them to be injured. Not necessarily injured bodily, but certainly psychologically. And we know that. I mean, if you have somebody you love who had an abortion, you've gone through this, you know the psychological ramifications that come from it. There is a post-abortive syndrome. It often manifests in you know, addictive behavior, codependent relationships, or finding women back in those abusive relationships. Or I knew one woman who became so depressed, she became suicidal. So, I mean, the evidence is very, very real. So one of the arguments for abortion has always been about, you know, it's always been that pregnancy can be psychologically painful for a woman, and the only way to relieve that pain is by ending the pregnancy as soon as possible. And that even excludes the possibility of going through with pregnancy in order to give the child up for adoption. Although I tend to think that would be the healthiest psychologically. But as one pro-abortion lawyer said in reaction to yesterday's argument, and again, this is a pro-abortion lawyer saying this, he said, quote, "Given how physically intrusive and biologically threatening a pregnancy is, The opportunity to give up children for adoption is completely irrelevant to the wholesale assault that the placenta wages against a woman's body. I mean, I'm not even going to reread it. I mean, it's ridiculous, right? But what the pro-abortion side only rarely acknowledges is that there are very real psychological scars left after abortion. That's something they don't want to talk about. And yet it's a reality. It's a byproduct of abortion. And there are women who have had multiple abortions. I shared that story with you. I had a friend who I worked with years and years ago. And she got pregnant and had an abortion. And then she got pregnant again and had an abortion. She finally got married. She married a guy who was becoming an attorney. He just finished law school and began to practice. And she got pregnant with twins, right? But they felt that they were such a weird point in their life that they couldn't afford to have kids. She was working. He was just starting his practice. So she aborted those two children. That's four children. When they were ready to have children, she could no longer have them. And the devastation, the impact, not only on her heart, on her head, on her mind, on her soul, on the family, were just devastating to her, just absolutely devastating. She's one of a number of stories that are out there. There are women who've had multiple abortions. And hey, look, I'll be fair. Some claim, it hasn't done anything to me. I'm fine, you know. I would tend not to believe that. I think there are deep, deep scars there. I'm joined today by Alan Parker. He's actually the president of the Justice Foundation in San Antonio. He's a former professor of law at St. Mary's University in San Antonio. And he actually, believe it or not, helped Norma McCorvey. If you don't know that name, she was the Jane Roe in Roe v. Wade. And he helped her write her 2003 affidavit, and then he wrote the brief for these injured women. I was talking about those 2,249 of them. And he joins us today. It's good to have him here with us. Thank you for what you've done. And if people want to learn more, I know they can go to thejusticefoundation.org, and I hope you'll do that. Good to have you with me, Alan. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Drew. It's very great to be with you on your program. And thank you for giving women a voice. You've told a story, and you're going to have Luena, who's going to tell her story of what abortion did to her. And it's one of the greatest honors of my life to represent 2,249 of them. And even the Supreme Court has admitted that abortion causes devastating psychological consequences to women. And so if it does, after we maybe hear Luana's story, there's a better way that Amy Kilmeade Barrett brought up in the oral argument called Safe Haven that we want to talk about as the alternative to abortion. But however you want to proceed, it's just a great honor to have clients like Luana and others.
Let's do this. Why don't you explain first exactly what is being presented here, you know, and how successful you think that'll be. I wish you all the success. And then let's hear Luana's story. We'll put it into perspective so people can really understand the damage that comes from making this mistake. But why don't you pick it up? Tell me a little bit about what you're doing right now and what you hope to achieve.
All right. And the big picture was these 2,249 women were also combined with the founder of the Moral Outcry, who has collected 539,000 signatures of people who have given the court five reasons for reversing Roe v. Wade. I'm going to give you the big three because sure. I think your audience can understand this and help us convince America that we would be better off, even women who might choose abortion. So the big argument is you are killing an infant life. It is a crime against humanity, and we now know that, and the Supreme Court has admitted it in a case in 2007. They said some women come to regret aborting the infant life they once created and sustained. So at the moment of the abortion, the court has admitted it's an infant life. And then they said severe depression and loss of esteem can follow. Okay, so we know it's an infant life. We know it hurts women. Why would we have abortion? Well, people say, what about the woman? There can be distressing circumstances. I represent thousands of women who had abortion. Some voluntarily chose it. Many were forced to have abortions. But no, today there's something called the Safe Haven Laws in every state. Amy Coney Barrett brought it up, and because there were two sentences about it in the the Mississippi brief, and our briefs, several of them, expounded 10 or 15, 20 pages, I don't remember, but a major point of our brief was no woman has to have an abortion to be free of the burden, if she feels it's a burden, of unwanted child. And so today, under safe haven law, any woman could drop her baby off at a hospital or fire station or other designated space, and she can be within a set period of time after birth, and she can be free of that burden. And Lorena, you're on the line. If that's you, you might mute until we ask you a question. That might.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that's her, but I'm sorry. Yeah, no, that's fine. Background in the back.
I wasn't sure what that was. That's fine. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So anyway, she can drop it off at a safe place designated by the state within a certain period of time after birth, and she can be free of the obligation to parent a child if she doesn't want to, or if she's in a circumstance where she feels she can't parent that child. So it's no cost procedure. She simply drops the baby off. It's equally available to the rich and the poor because it costs nothing, unlike the abortion industry trying to make money and get $600 to give you a pill, or that doesn't cost anywhere near that, or $1,000 or $1,500, depending on where you live. So there's a free alternative called Safe Haven Law. And Amy Coney Barrett said to the abortion industry and to the government administration, the Biden administration, Solicitor General of the United States, doesn't the safe haven eliminate the burden for women? And that was basically her question. And the government, the answer was, well, women don't want to be pregnant. But today, we could stop the killing of the child in exchange for a few months of pregnancy, which is serious. The state is giving freedom of 18 years of expense and parenting obligation. So we believe that this is why Roe v. Wade will be reversed. And yet no one will have to parent a child she doesn't want.
Amen to that. Well, I'll tell you what, Alan, why don't you hold the thought? I'm going to take a short pause. When we come back, I would love to hear Llewellyn's story. If you want to join us too, our number here is 888-914-9149. We're taking a look at such a momentous time, I think, in American history, one of the biggest Supreme Court cases perhaps of our lifetime now unfolding. We're talking with, of course, Alan Parker from the Justice Foundation, as well as an amicus for women who've been injured by abortion. Stay with me. You're going to hear an amazing story when I return. Hi, Drew Mariani here. Hey, I am traveling to the Holy Land in February with our underwriting sponsor, Nativity Pilgrimage. Information is available at relevantradio.com/Holy Land. That's relevantradio.com/Holy Land.
The Drew Mariani Show.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Faith over fear.
Yeah, that's what we need. I mean, you can get distressed in light of the current culture, but I see great things rising in the future. Right? There's a lot of hope out there, isn't there? I think life, we're going to win, you know, another great battle in the war to preserve the most vulnerable amongst us. And I'm so grateful for guests like Alan Parker, who is the president of the Justice Foundation in San Antonio. You can check them out at justicefoundation.org for his using his talents and his skills to help advance that culture of life. Of course, he's joined by Llewellyn, who has an amazing story to tell. And I think it's important you hear really from the mouth of those who've made the mistake. And I often say this, women who have abortions, they're not bad. They don't do this because they have evil in their heart. They do it because they find themselves in a compromising situation and don't think there's any other alternative, any other way out. But there is. And Alan, maybe you can introduce Llewellyn for us if you could.
Well, thank you very much. At thejusticefoundation.org, you can find one of our projects called Operation Outcry and Silent No More. And it's similar to the Silent No More Awareness Campaign, which is women giving their testimonies in public so America know that abortion hurts women. We specialize in getting this in the written, legally admissible affidavit or declaration under penalty of perjury on our website. Wow. And Llewellyn is one of the courageous women who not only signed the declaration, and you can actually be anonymous on that. We will protect your identity if you haven't told your family or others you've had an abortion. This is a big secret pain in America, and the court and legislatures need to know it. So she's willing to testify publicly, and what you're about to hear in a written form was one of the testimonies that we've given to the Supreme Court. And so they know, and they're hearing in writing from about 4,000 women like this. Actually, we represented 2,000 of them as amicus parties, but we put 4,000 testimonies. So I pray that the Supreme Court listen and hear these testimonies, as you're going to hear from Luena.
Thank you so much, Drew and Alan.
You're welcome.
I just want to say, if there are other women who have been hurt by abortion, they can go on to OperationOutcry.org and they can sign that petition, or they can find other ways to find help. But yes, I am a woman that was hurt by abortion. I believed the lie of the abortion industry when I was a teenager and was pregnant. And my first abortion, I had three, but my first abortion, I believed that lie that it was just a clump of cells, a blob of tissue, and they told me that it would be safe. They told me it'd be even safer than carrying to term. And so I went ahead with that procedure, and it spun my life into devastation. I started abusing alcohol. I started abusing drugs, became very guilty, full of shame and depression, and tried to commit suicide several times. And then that lifestyle led to a very promiscuous lifestyle. And so I was pregnant two more times and chose abortion both those times. The industry is not a safe place, and it's not a place that cares about women or is health care. I didn't even use my real name for the last abortion that I had. I gave him a friend of mine's name. Often wonder what would have happened if I would have died on the table that day. But after I found the Lord and my life began to turn around, I got married and wanted to have children. And because of the damage done to my tubes and uterus, I could not have children. So, Drew, I killed the only children I would ever bear.
Well,
and if you think of it, just like the story you told before, you think of how does a woman live with that her whole life, that she killed her children, especially if you do learn the truth. And we have ultrasounds and technology now that proves that this is a life at conception. My babies had fingers and toes and brainwaves and a heartbeat and fingernails. And it's just unimaginable to think of how that would devastate women psychologically, emotionally, mentally, in every way. And it does affect women physically as well. So we adopted a son, which speaks to the safe haven laws. There are other options out there for women. We don't need to have this horrible option of death to kill our children. We can put them in safe haven, or we can place them up for adoption. There are other options. There are better choices.
So how are you doing today, Luena? I mean, you're not alone. There's so many women who can just, they can relate your story in such an intimate, in such a powerful way. Have you been able to find the healing that you sought? And what advice would you give to some other woman right now who has made the mistake and just can't forgive herself?
Yeah, there is help out there, and I thank God that there is help. So I have found help for my abortions. I've gone through several post-abortive counseling options and Bible studies. I've been through Forgiven and Set Free and Surrendering the Secret. I've been to some retreats like Rachel's Vineyard and some other things like that. I also teach post-abortion counseling and classes through the pregnancy resource centers, and those are wonderful avenues. The pregnancy resource centers, Birthright, there are many options out there for women to find help, get help, go through that counseling she needs, and just walk through that healing process so that she can come to grips with that, what she has done, but then ask the Lord for healing. And the Lord will forgive us. He says he throws our sins as far as the east is from the west if we will ask for forgiveness. So I am doing much better. But, you know, it really does never end, because I'm at the age now where I could have had grandchildren, and I don't, because those children are missing. And so it's not just one life that is missing. It is generations and generations and generations of lives. It's many lives. You know, who have we killed in this travesty of abortion?
That's really so true. And it's not just the woman either. I have a friend whose girlfriend got pregnant, and she ended up having an abortion. He did everything he could to stop her from doing it. But he said, I remember him saying to me one time, he says, you know, Drew, so often it's the woman. He says, but when I was raising, when I'd be out and I'd see a father pushing his son on a swing because he was 3 or 4 years old, I thought that's the age my son would be. Years later, he saw a father throwing a ball with his son. That would have been my son. And throughout these, I would have taught my son to drive. He missed his son through all this. So the ripple effect, it's not just the woman. I mean, she suffers intimately with this, of course, but it does. It affects the man, I think, as well. It affects society at large because we really are a global family. We're all connected that way. Has anybody done any estimate on how many posts of board of people there are out there right now? And how is this manifesting? I know so often when women or men make this mistake, they double down on it. And that's why we see them champion and try to advance the culture of death. And I think sometimes that's done just out of woundedness. What are your thoughts?
I think go ahead, Luana.
No, you go ahead, Alan.
Well, I think there are millions of women out there that have had abortions. And Luana's story, some people on the pro-life side, well, if you have one, how could you possibly have another? Yeah. But she talked about that downward spiral of depression. Again, everything I know about abortion comes from women who've had it. You feel worthless. You may get in an abusive relationship, and then you get pregnant, and you feel, I can't bring a child into this situation. So it's terrible. And if there are about 600 or to a million abortions a year, and even as low as 10%, well, we think at least 50% of the women suffer severe psychological consequences, but 10% of 600,000 is 60,000 women a year. And so the safe haven is a beautiful alternative. As a society, we can say, don't kill your child. Let's give justice to the child. And let's not commit a crime against humanity like slavery or segregation, where we said to a class of humans, you get no legal rights because there's a right to life in the Constitution. And don't hurt yourself. Let's have mercy for the women. Don't hurt yourself, please. You might be one of those ones with, as the court says, devastating psychological consequences. Give us your baby. And the last thing is, Luana is not alone in being infertile. There are about 6 million women a year who can't have a baby after a year of trying, and about 2 million of them every year say, I would love to be a mother to a newborn. I will take a child. I can be a good mother and provide a good home. So I call it the love, love, love solution. Let's love the baby. Let's love the mothers. And let's love the people who are waiting to adopt newborn children.
I've got a son and a daughter-in-law who are looking into adoption because right now, they have not been able to have a child. And, I often say that if there's any woman who doesn't, think she can take her child or she's thinking about an abortion, there are so many loving families that in a heartbeat would go ahead and embrace that child as Luana did. I only have about a moment left. Luana, I want to give you final thoughts and then Alan, I'll give it to you as well. In fact, I only have a minute. So Luana, let me give you final thoughts.
Okay, I would just say to any woman who is out there struggling with this, she's had an abortion, she's afraid to talk about it, or she's just hurting, that there is help for her and there is healing for her, that God loves her and God will forgive her. And so jump on OperationOutcry.org and find that help that you need. There's a helpline on there that she can call as well. And there are just so many organizations, including Operation Outcry, that's there to help her. You're not alone. God loves you. There's hope and there's healing beyond abortion. There truly is.
Well, Luana, thank you for your witness and for your courage and for bringing good out of that situation. And Alan, thank you. Check out the Justice Foundation and let's pray. We'll do that when I return. Stay with me.